This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. On this week's show, the unknown fate of hundreds of Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped weeks ago by Boko Haram draws international outcry. Immigration reform advocates visit lawmakers, urging them to end a controversial immigration detention quota. And students across the U.S. face a new online standardized test as part of the Common Core curriculum. Some charter schools react. All that and more on today's weekly edition of FSRN. International efforts are now underway to help Nigerian security forces locate more than 230 schoolgirls kidnapped weeks ago by terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant Islamist sect has accepted responsibility for the kidnappings and says they plan to sell the young girls into slavery. The mass abduction prompted international outrage after Nigerians put the issue on the world agenda via a viral social media campaign. The U.S. has dispatched a multi-agency team to aid the rescue effort, and California Senator Dianne Feinstein says national security officials should release any relevant intelligence information they may have to assist in the search. U.S. President Barack Obama says this may be the event that helps to mobilize the entire international community to finally do something against Boko Haram. The girls' parents claim the government failed to act swiftly following the abduction from their school dormitories in Chibok, northeastern Nigeria. Sema Lukoya reports from Lagos.
In Nigeria's cities and as far away as London and Washington, street protests demand action from the Nigerian government to locate and free the 230 girls abducted more than 3 weeks ago by members of the militant Islamist group Boko Haram. The protesters and the parents are angry that the Nigerian government failed to react immediately after the mass abduction. Mata Yarama Undirapa is one of the parents that joined the protest.
They've been promising us that these girls will be found. But up to today, up to this moment I am talking, nothing has been done. No single security personnel has gone to that bush to look for these girls as I am talking now.
Boko Haram, the Islamist group behind the abductions, is fighting for the imposition of Sharia law in Nigeria. On Monday, Boko Haram released a video taking responsibility for the abductions and stating its intent to sell the girls into slavery. Many believe the Islamist group plans to force the underage girls into marriage. This has only deepened the anxiety of the parents of the missing girls. This man, who asked not to be identified by name, is one of the parents.
We don't know where they are, and we don't know what is happening to them. The parents at home cannot do anything. Some refuse to eat. Please, we are begging the federal government of Nigeria. Please, we are begging our army, which we depend on them. Please, intervene into this matter for us.
Some say the lack of swift government action may even be encouraging the militants. News of another group abduction came to light this week. At least 11 girls were reportedly taken when Boko Haram attacked a Nigerian village near the Cameroonian border on Monday. Some reports put the death toll from that attack as high as 300. Violence in northeastern Nigeria has spiked in recent months in the context of a Boko Haram offensive. Amnesty International estimates around 1,500 people were killed in the region in the last 3 months of this year. President Goodluck Jonathan imposed a state of emergency on the region a year ago. Isaac Wanke, who attended a recent protest against Boko Haram's abductions of schoolgirls, says the government's approach has been ineffective.
The government should focus on people. People are dying, people are losing their lives, people are scared, and you need to provide succor now. You need to give us hope, some sort of hope, any sort of hope, because fear is a very difficult emotion to control.
The mass abductions of schoolgirls has prompted international outrage. The United States has offered to send law enforcement officials, military personnel, and experts in hostage situations to Nigeria as part of the rescue effort. Britain, France, and China have also offered assistance. But many Nigerians feel the offers of help from abroad will only be effective if Nigerian authorities show more commitment. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Advocates for immigration reform continue to call for presidential action to halt deportations. Undocumented mothers from around the country came to Washington, D.C. ahead of Mother's Day to ask for the expansion of deferred action to keep immigrant and mixed status families together. Others lobbied congressional representatives to end what's known as the bed quota in the immigration detention system. These actions were held on the heels of a recently concluded hunger strike in an immigrant detention facility in the Pacific Northwest. Shannon Young has more.
Immigration reform activists have been busy in recent weeks, keeping their issues not only in the public eye, but also on the agenda of lawmakers. One attention-grabbing tactic involved hunger strikes inside immigration detention centers in Tacoma, Washington, and Conroe, Texas. The GEO Group owns both facilities. On Thursday, U.S. Representative Adam Smith of Washington State introduced the Accountability in Immigration Detention Act, legislation that would set enforceable standards for conditions at both public and private facilities. Seattle-based immigration attorney Angelica Chacero described the bill as one of the victories of the 56-day hunger strike, which concluded May 1st.
Detainees until now have really been treated as individuals by ICE, individuals as GEO, and so coming together and having a collective action really made people stop and take notice. And so for Congress people to be forced to come to the facility in person to talk to detainees, not to talk to ICE in their offices, not to talk to GEO group in their offices, but to come to the facility and talk to groups of detained men and women, really just changes how politics is done around immigration detention.
Proponents of immigration reform point to a line item in the Department of Homeland Security's budget, which requires immigration authorities to be able to maintain at least 34,000 detainees in custody each night. They call it the bed quota.
ICE's budget just for detention alone is nearly $2 billion a year.
That's Madhu Grewal, policy counsel at the Detention Watch Network. Members of the organization met with over a dozen congressional representatives on Wednesday, urging them to end the detention bed mandate.
Congress needs to do something about the issue of mass detention in this country, and it's not going to be solved simply by asking ICE to fix conditions, but really forcing ICE to lower its detention numbers. And the way we're really going to get there is by eliminating policies like the quota.
Representatives Bill Foster and Ted Deutsch introduced an amendment last year to eliminate the bed mandate, but it failed to pass. The two are expected to introduce a similar amendment next month if the quota remains in the DHS budget proposal. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Over the past decade, thousands of people from Bolivia have migrated to Brazil, attracted by economic growth. Fleeing a life of dire poverty at home, they often find jobs in the textile sector of Sao Paulo, South America's wealthiest city. Many immigrants who lack proper documents, money, and shelter end up working in illegal sweatshops. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
Sao Paulo's Cantuta Square, also known as the Bolivian Fair, is a cultural meeting point for the city's Bolivian immigrant population. An estimated 50,000 to 200,000 Bolivians live in Sao Paulo. The numbers vary so drastically because most enter Brazil overland and do not register with the authorities. Bolivians in Sao Paulo usually find work in the textile industry, sewing clothes for local retail outlets. 23-year-old Oscar Mejera has worked in the textile industry since he arrived in Sao Paulo 5 years ago, from the Bolivian city of Cochabamba. He sends money back home and intends to return to Bolivia in 2 years. Mejera says that the wages are higher here, but the work days are long and hard.
Our situation is difficult, but at least we have work. It's not easy, but we get used to it. We work a lot, you know, like 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. each day. This is the hardest part.
As Bolivian immigration into Sao Paulo has increased over recent years, so have the documented cases of exploitative labor practices in the textile industry.
uma enorme fronteira.
Luiz Alexandra Faria is a labor ministry inspector in charge of coordinating investigations into sweatshop labor in Sao Paulo. He says many Bolivians arrive in Sao Paulo without money or a place to stay, owing fees to human smugglers. These conditions make them extremely vulnerable to debt bondage.
Chega da Bolívia, ele tem aí dois, três.
It's very common that when they first arrive, they work for nothing, for maybe the first 5 months until they have paid off the debts that they have accumulated from traveling here.
The new arrivals usually find work in cramped, precarious spaces shared by multiple families known as offices. Workers often sew for upwards of 16 hours a day for pay that is far below minimum wage. Faria says he has found workers who earn $40 a month. The offices also double as living spaces. For children living in these conditions, respiratory infections are rife. A law passed in 2009 gives all foreign workers found in sweatshop conditions the right to remain in Brazil. Companies found guilty by the Supreme Court of using sweatshop labor are put on a lista suja, a dirty list, which makes it difficult to do business in Brazil. 31-year-old OP, who uses only his initials to remain anonymous, came to Sao Paulo with his wife and two children 4 years ago. They came from the poor rural outskirts of a city in central Bolivia. Another Bolivian brought them to Sao Paulo. OP says he and his wife worked for a Korean boss from 6 a.m. until midnight every day for a combined monthly salary of $650. Sao Paulo State's minimum wage for sewing work is $450 per person per month for a 35-hour week.
The Koreans pay very little. They pay $1 or maybe 70 cents per piece for things that require a lot of work, t-shirts, dresses. And then they sell the pieces for much more, $25 or maybe $30. We are completely exploited. And the conditions to complain don't exist for those who work illegally. We have to work. We need money, work documents, everything.
The Sao Paulo Ministry of Labor and Employment recently found OP and his wife working and living in a tiny one-room office in what authorities described as sweatshop conditions. OP and his wife were unknowingly producing clothes items for a large Brazilian brand for $4 or $5 per piece, which would then be sold for up to $300 each. A third-party subcontractor had hired the couple. The brand, Emmy Officer, has denied any knowledge of the working conditions, but was ordered to pay OP $2,200 in compensation. Under the 2009 ruling, he and his family have the right to stay in Brazil. While Sao Paulo's sweatshop trade has traditionally been dominated by Koreans, experts now say that the market is being taken over by smaller, Bolivian-run offices. In March, the Ministry of Labor raided an office in Etacaquecetuba, about 26 miles from central Sao Paulo, and found 14 Bolivians working in sweatshop conditions. According to Faria, the governmental investigator, due to an increase in sweatshop raids and rising rents, sweatshops that were mainly situated in central Sao Paulo are now moving to the city periphery and to the interior of the state, farther away from the eye of the authorities. Sam Cowie for FSRN, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
The two major Palestinian political parties, Hamas and Fatah, recently reached a reconciliation agreement under which they agree to set up a unity government for both Gaza and the West Bank. The new government is expected to be in place in the next few weeks. Residents of Gaza look forward to less internal strife in the region, yet they still live in the shadow of more than 30 miles of barriers and fencing that separates Gaza and Israel. A ribbon of land, about 1,000 feet wide, runs along the fence on the Gaza side. It's known as the buffer zone. But as Rami Almagari reports, this so-called buffer is not a strip of safety for civilians in the area.
Ouda Jihad Hamad died on his 27th birthday, shot by Israeli soldiers near the northeastern border of the territory. Hamad was unemployed at the time. His wife and family are still shocked by his death. Warda Sihwel is his stepmother. She says he was such a kind family member.
He was trying to earn a living by collecting junk metal or plastic right near the border. It was December 20th when he told us that he was going to earn some money so he could celebrate his birthday. That same day, he and his wife were set to undergo fertility treatments in hopes his wife would conceive. He went off that day happily, but he never came back. May he rest in peace.
Oda's family lives in a modest asbestos-roofed house in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. He and his wife of 4 years lived in the same home with 10 other family members. He was one of many civilians who tried to seek out a living collecting scrap metal near the border. Others tried to make a living farming land close to the fence. Human Rights Watch says Israeli army shootings against unarmed civilians in the buffer zone have increased in the past months, with dozens dead. The group has called on Israel to avoid harming civilians in what they say are violations of international law. Among those killed in the first few months of the year were a developmentally disabled woman, a teenager picnicking with a friend to celebrate the end of the school year, and a hiker photographing wildlife. According to Azam Sha'ath of the Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the intensity of army actions has increased despite an Egypt-brokered ceasefire between Israel and the Gaza-based armed factions reached in 2012.
It is clear that those border areas are buffer zones that are being expanded or narrowed from time to time, yet this does not exempt the occupation state from its responsibility for the safety of unarmed people by differentiating them between civilians and fighters. Such Israeli attacks are contradicting the provisions of international humanitarian law.
According to Human Rights Watch, Israeli Army spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner defended the shootings, saying military action is warranted by the prevailing state of conflict. The 2012 ceasefire deal followed Israel's 8-day attack on the coastal Palestinian enclave. Part of the deal was that Israel would allow farmers along the border to return to their fields, abandoned since 2003. It's not yet clear what effect the new Palestinian government, if successfully convened, will have on Israel's military posture along the buffer zone. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Thailand, an ethnic Karen activist went missing just as he was preparing a legal case against the chief of the National Park and National Park Department. The ethnic Karen are hill tribe farmers who by tradition use slash-and-burn agriculture and other long-standing farming methods. This often brings them into conflict with local authorities, especially when farming near national forest areas. The Karen largely live in Myanmar, also known as Burma, but they also live in areas across north and western Thailand. As Ron Corbin reports, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is concerned about the missing activists' welfare and an ongoing climate of impunity.
Ethnic Karen environmental activist Polachi Rakchong Charon disappeared in late April after park officials say he was briefly detained by Kang Krachan National Park Chief Chaiwat Limit Kit Takason at a checkpoint, was questioned and later released. When Billy disappeared, he was reportedly carrying documents related to a 2011 case involving 20 ethnic Karen villagers who were evicted and their homes burnt by park officials. Kittisak Ratana Krachangsari, an advisor to a non-government organization aiding ethnic communities in Thailand, says there are now real fears for Polachi's safety. The court case has put Polachi and the Karen village in direct conflict with the senior park officials. Kittisak explains.
At the time,
the affected villagers thought it was unfair. That's why they seek support from the Thai Lawyers Council to help them file a lawsuit against the head of the Kang Krachan National Park, also the Department of National Park Wildlife and Plant Conservation.
While the ethnic Karen largely live in neighboring Myanmar, the Karen also reside in large areas of Thailand. Many follow traditional patterns of agriculture of slash and burn. Saw Paul Sien Thua, director of Thai-based Karen Environmental and Social Action Network, says there is regular conflict over land use between Karen communities and Thai officials. National Park Chief Chaiwat says he detained Polachi on April 17 at a local checkpoint in the park in Phetchaburi province in southern Thailand, accusing Polachi of carrying illegally gathered honey before letting him go. Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch Phil Robinson is concerned.
This national park chief has been implicated in violence against other people in the Karen ethnic community in the past. And therefore, it's a very, very worrisome situation.
Geneva-based UN Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasimi, says such disappearances create a climate of impunity.
If, you know, authorities at whatever level are able to carry out any kind of intimidation, assault, or even worse, disappearance of activists without any kind of accountability, this encourages this kind of behavior, and it shows that it is acceptable. So impunity is a big concern for us.
Saul Paul Sientois says Polachi's disappearance has already cast a pall over the local Karen community.
Yes, that is very concerning, and also sends a signal to, you know, other environmentalists, you know, that security is threatened. So we are waiting for the government taking action on this. I think even for the local people, Korean people who live in the area there, they live in fear. And even now, they're really afraid of what happened next.
Despite Polachi's absence, the Karen villagers and Thai activists are pressing ahead with a court hearing. But the Lawyers' Council of Thailand has already warned the case may be undermined, as Polachi played a key role in collecting witness accounts and other information for the court. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
Students in many states have long used a freshly sharpened number 2 pencil to bubble in answers on a yearly battery of tests. But this spring, in a nationwide overhaul of public school standardized assessments, students across the country are taking what for many may be their first ever online exam in a dry run of a new test. The new computerized, smarter balanced test assesses student learning based on new academic standards called Common Core. For many students, this new techno test replaces old school paper and pencil tests. California is one of all but 5 U.S. states that have adopted the Common Core standards of education. The state's public school system includes more than 1,100 charter schools. FSRN's Karen Argood looks at what's at stake in that shift to technology for some public charter schools.
While many public schools start their day with a Pledge of Allegiance, students at Stonebridge, a public charter school in Napa, begin their mornings with music. Music and drama are part of the conscious choice of this Waldorf Methodist charter school. And according to Stonebridge administrator Bill Bindewall, so is the decision to not use public school textbooks or technology for teaching.
You know, the ideals of charter schools is that it's a different type of an educational approach. So there's parental choice to do something different. And one of those choices that we've made as a public Waldorf school is to not have technology in classrooms of our K-8 program.
Charter schools are a part of the public education system. And what makes these schools different is that they are exempt from much of the state education code and have freedom and flexibility in curriculum design, in exchange for meeting performance standards. As part of the public education system, they are tuition-free and funded by taxpayer dollars. Alice Miller, the Director of Knowledge Management for the California Charter Schools Association, says that because charter schools are a part of the state school system, they must participate in the state standardized testing that is required for other public schools, including this year's dry run of the new Smarter Balance test.
So they're going to have to adapt their methodologies to include access to computer technology at an earlier age.
The issue for charter schools is not so much with the new standards themselves, but rather that the new tests require computer technology. And some charter schools say that these new computerized tests impinge upon their freedom to design their own models of education. Waldorf Methods and Montessori charter schools are concerned that students will have to be trained how to take a test on a computer using new software and hardware teaching platforms where none existed before.
And they're not very happy about it, but they also recognize that it's a requirement and they have to do the same testing that other schools do.
Miller notes that both schools do not use computers until the middle school years. They base instruction around a student's brain development, and once the switch is made to online testing, she says their entire instructional approach will be changed. But not without a fight, says Stonebridge fourth grade teacher Megan Hill, who insists that the government is imposing new testing requirements that run counter to the choice of her public school's charter.
We keep our children away from technology for a long time for specific reasons, and that's not the focus of this interview. It is, however, the focus of our charter, and now the state is imposing upon us to break our charter.
Miller says the online testing poses other problems for charter schools as well. They need sufficient bandwidth.
Schools have a very narrow window in which they can administer the test, and that applies to charter schools as well as traditional schools. And you need to be able to have a fairly large number of students with internet access on a simultaneous basis in order to complete the test on time. I have one charter school with approximately 27 students in a very rural area that barely has telephone service and has had an extremely difficult time getting any kind of internet access at all.
Acquiring enough computers for the Common Core testing presents yet another challenge for charters. New charter schools will have a tougher time getting started because they will have missed out on the one-time Common Core implementation grant of $200 per student. That means they won't get state financial support for the additional startup costs of student computers and adequate bandwidth that otherwise they may not have needed. Some charter school administrators have expressed concerns about accommodating special needs students who can require a wide variety of individualized testing methods. And it's still unclear how the delivery of the online Smarter Balance tests can be manipulated to meet their needs. As public charter schools continue to navigate these issues, those like Stonebridge will continue to teach their curricula before keyboarding. As in this woodworking class where fifth grade students are not making a birdhouse, but are carving an egg.
So focus on the edges.
Instructor Ron Liske says this egg project is one of the harder ones because if you do anything wrong, you have to redo the whole egg.
And what they're learning here is to develop determination, to imagine three-dimensional object in a chunk of wood and to find their way through it. All the way to the end. It might take half a year before they've gotten to where they're trying to go. There's very few projects in a student's life that require that much determination.
Stonebridge and a handful of Waldorf Method charters plan to lobby the state legislature for age-appropriate Common Core testing delivery environments. In the meantime, students will continue testing the Smarter Balance tests until June, and the results will not be shared with the public. Karen Argood, FSRN, Napa.
And that does it for today's show. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our program and by listeners like you. For more information, please visit our website at fsrn.org. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.